Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project, promoting informed discussion of issues related to California state governance and civic engagement. I'm Zabre Valentine, Director of Voices of Reform, and I want to thank you for joining us to discuss California's initiative process. Polls indicate that people all over the state like the power of the initiative, yet they are also frustrated by the process and want it to work better. Is this possible, and if so, how? The Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform programs are made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and Commonwealth Club members. Today's program will be moderated by Ginger Rutland, Associate Editor with the Sacramento Bee. Ms. Rutland has been a member of the Bee's editorial board since 1988, where she covers transportation, criminal justice, the courts, voting systems, public employee pensions, and gambling, among other issues. Ms. Rutland is also a weekly commentator for Capital Public Radio, the local NPR station. Before joining the Bee, Ms. Rutland was a television reporter for 17 years. And now I'm very pleased to turn the program over to Ginger Rutland to moderate today's discussion.
Thank you, Zabre. Thank you, Zabre, and welcome. We have three distinguished panelists with a lot to say about initiatives, and I want to get straight to it. First, Robert Stern is president of the Center for Governmental Studies, a nonpartisan political and media research organization based in Los Angeles. Mr. Stern was a principal co-author of the Political Reform Act of 1974, Proposition 9, which was approved by over 70% of the voters. I think I voted for that one myself. Prior to his current position, Mr. Stern was general counsel to the California Fair Political Practices Commission, and in the early 70s, he was counsel to the California Secretary of State's office and the Assembly Elections and Reapportionment Committee. He's been studying initiatives for years, and he's the go-to guy for reporters like me who need to know something about what's going on with initiatives. Second panelist is Senator Deborah Bowen. She represents the 28th Senate District in an area. It is an area that stretches down the coast of California from Venice to Redondo Beach. She has been in the legislature for more than a decade, first elected to the California Assembly in 1992. She is currently chair of the Senate Elections and Reapportionment Committee. And although the biography I was given didn't mention this, I think it's important to point out that Senator Bowen is an announced candidate for the Democratic nomination for Secretary of State. And if she's elected, she'll have a lot to do with initiatives in this state. And our third panelist is George Duff Sundheim. He was elected chair of the California Republican Party in 2003. He campaigned on a pledge to unify the party. Under his leadership, the California Republican Party has raised more than $24 million and signed up more than 400,000 new Republican voters. Mr. Sundheim is an attorney, and he received his law degree from Northwestern University and his BA from Stanford, where he lettered in football. And football, I think, is good training for Republicans in California politics these days. All right. Anyway, welcome. We're so happy to have you here. The first thing we're going to do is have each of you give us an opening statement and talk about initiatives. And we are going to start with you, Mr. Stern.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to acknowledge Tracy Weston and Steve Levin in my office who are here and who helped develop the draft recommendations that hopefully most of you have. We started studying the initiative process in the early 90s at the Center for Governmental Studies. We came out with a book called Democracy by Initiative, Shaping California's Fourth Branch of Government. And in that book, we had a number of recommendations. But the basis for the book was saying that the initiative process in California should be preserved but improved. Voters have indicated that they want the initiative process. They have more faith in the initiative process than they do in the legislative process, which I think is a shame, but that's the reality. So the voters are never going to abolish the initiative process, but I think the voters also recognize there are major problems with the initiative process. They don't like the fact the initiatives are too long. They don't like the fact that they're confusing. They don't like the number of initiatives they have to vote on. They don't like all the special interest money that comes in. They think the initiative process has been captured by special interests. And so the voters, I think, are willing to look at improvements as long as they feel that the initiative process will be preserved. And so that's why we've come out with a number of draft recommendations. The most essential, if I can get into the most essential, I think, is the initiative process should be more like the legislative process. We should return to the time where we had indirect initiatives where they had to go to the legislature first. and the legislature could consider it. And if the legislature passed a measure that was being circulated, that was actually had qualified for the ballot, that it would be taken off the ballot. We've had examples like that, the workers' comp measure, where the governor was ready to turn in signatures. The legislature agreed to work with the governor and passed a workers' comp that was acceptable to both sides. A lemon law initiative, where consumer groups had circulated a measure dealing with returning automobiles if they were lemons. And the new car dealers went to the consumer groups and said, don't turn in your signatures. Can we work out some legislation? And they did. Charter schools, another example. So we've had examples where initiative proponents voluntarily have gone to the legislature first. We would require that. We wouldn't extend the number of days in terms of delaying the initiative going on the ballot. We think probably about 15% of initiatives would probably be approved by the legislature and taken off the ballot, thus reducing voter burden. Now, here's the controversial part, and the part that I'm sure will raise some hackles. After the legislature says, no, we're not going to approve your initiative, we don't like term limits or we don't like campaign financing, so go ahead, put it on the ballot. The proponents have been through a legislative hearing, have learned about their initiative, learned a lot of things about their initiative, and we would let the proponents then amend their initiative, provided it furthered the purposes and intent, was approved by the Attorney General or by a court. And thus an improved initiative, a better initiative, would go on the ballot. For instance, take an example, the governor's initiative dealing with pensions, where Bill Lockyer, the Attorney General, said that there was a problem that it was going to affect widows and orphans. The governor could have amended that initiative and put it on the ballot. There was another example where a reform group circulated an initiative that actually repealed a limit on gifts to legislators by accident. They would have been allowed to amend that to correct it. So we think merging the initiative process and the legislative process is an essential reform.
Our next speaker is Deborah Bowen. What do you think of his ideas, Deborah?
Thank you. Well, first, thank you to the Commonwealth Club for doing this. Bob, I want you to know that I have that book on my shelf at home, and I guess I should open it again. It's been a few years. I actually carried a bill in 1997 that does many of the things that you talked about. It was ACA 11, and it would have set up a procedure by which the legislature could review and pass an initiative. Like many other fine pieces of public policy, it did not get out of the assembly.
The B endorsed it.
I think it's important for us to remember where the initiative process comes from. It came from the progressive era in the Hiram Johnson administration, a Republican governor, and it was a response to the power that the railroads had over pretty much every aspect of the life of Californians, because railroads were critical at that point in California's economy. There weren't any other ways to move people and goods, so it was a classic monopoly, and it had the railroads had a tremendous amount of political power. So the initiative was born out of a very good instinct to put some checks and balances on the legislative process and to give people a way to deal directly with issues affecting them. What's happened, particularly in the last 10 years or so, is that we've seen initiatives be more and more focused on wedge politics, wedge issue politics, and on particular economic issues that affect specific groups. And there's probably no better example of that than Proposition 78 and 79 in this most recent ballot. We have major problems with disclosure of how contributions are going into initiative campaigns, who is paying to circulate the initiatives, simply just advising people when they're signing a petition whether or not the circulator is being paid would go, I think, a long ways in helping Californians understand what's going on. There's this sense that's, I think, quite wrong that most of the people who are out sitting in front of the Costco or the Save-On are volunteers who are spending their days sitting there because they really believe in something. Going back to that model, I think, would serve California very well. That might mean extending the circulation time and raising the number of signatures to basically enable it to be a grassroots tool once again. But without having much better disclosure of the money, both that initiative proponents are putting in before qualification and then during campaigns, I think we will continue to see extremely mixed results and initiatives on the ballot that the public doesn't view as being a part of the exercise of checks and balance on the legislature. And we all got a very clear message about calling a special election just to deal with initiatives. I'd like to see a provision that says you cannot call a special election in California unless you have a vacancy to fill or you have a state of emergency and the initiatives in question are directly related to that state of emergency. We could start with that and voters would be much happier.
Duff?
Well, I first of all want to thank you for having me on the panel. I think that reform is an important element of what this state is all about. If California is going to return to a position of leadership, we have to be at the forefront of these types of issues. I think the initiative process, as the other members of the panel have indicated, is an important part of our system in California, and I would like to preserve it. I would agree with the other panelists that a more deliberative process, I think, would be helpful to the process. What I would like to do, though, is I'm not tied to this, but I would think the legislative portion and the other things that were talked about, I don't disagree with. I just think you may want to include that before you do the signature gathering route, because I think if you have a situation where you have all the signatures gathered, you go to legislature, you find out you have all these problems, which exist in Proposition 13, the three strikes law, Proposition 98, there's a lot of stuff in there that there's general agreement that those are good things, but they become sacrosanct as part of our process, and so it's difficult to get at those issues. But if you have a system where you make those changes and you allow the proponent after the legislature has dealt with them to modify them, I think you will be heightening the role that Deborah is concerned about, where people are using the initiative process to raise their profile, because you're now putting the proponent in a very powerful position to modify it without having to go back to the people that gathered the signatures in the first place. So I think my concern more is at what point in the process we involve the legislature, but I think getting their input and the tools that they have are an important part of the process. Bob mentioned the Attorney General in his review. I think we have seen this cycle the limitations on the effectiveness of that. I think Bill Lockyer was down at the Democrat convention and patting himself on the back for the role he played in making those initiatives more difficult to pass. So I think the Attorney General may not be the person that we want to go to for this unbiased opinion, but I think having somebody with an unbiased position, I would be okay with their reviewing the process. Okay. With respect to the grassroots, the only problem I have with that, I think, because now most of it's done through paid work, is in our state, the unions are considered volunteers. And so if they are considered to be the grassroots and you make it easier for them to implement things, I think you'll have a situation where you would have a lot of union-backed initiatives getting on the ballot, and I don't know if that's good for the process.
I get from Bob here that he disagrees with you in very fundamental way on some things that you said, Duff.
I don't want to say fundamental ways, because I think we're agreeing on the overall concept. But I don't, and Deborah should weigh in on this, I don't think the legislature will take an initiative seriously until it's gathered the signatures, until the proponents show that they're about to go on the ballot. And at that point, the legislature will take it seriously. So I think that's the – we had originally said 25%. In the book, we actually said 25%. We've now said, no, 100%. Take it seriously. The second thing is signature gathering doesn't mean anything. All it means is you have enough money to get to pay the people. If you have $1.5 million, you can qualify anything for the ballot. I facetiously once said, just pay the state $1.5 million, like a candidate does. A candidate pays a filing fee. Have the initiative proponent pay a filing fee. And Tom Umberg, an assemblyman who's your counterpart, the head of the Assembly Elections Committee, said he's going to introduce a bill saying pay the state $5 million and you're on the ballot. Now, I know people react against that, but in a sense, it helps the deficit, doesn't it? And if you have the $5 million, you're going to qualify anyway. So we're not recommending that, but Tom Umberg is suggesting it.
How about if we take that idea and we have a $5 million fee and then $2.5 million is allocated for advertising for each side and no one else can go outside that $2.5 million?
Well, of course, you can't
have a problem with the
Constitution. I understand, but... You know, I mean, I think the goal is to try to get people to be able to judge what's in these initiatives without having I mean, just look at the amount of money the pharmaceutical industry poured into 78 and 79, and they got what they wanted, which was people voted, didn't distinguish, except in Alpine County, where there are 860 registered voters, and I believe 612 of them voted aye on Proposition 79.
Well, they didn't get what they wanted. I mean, they really wanted 78 to pass, so they didn't, because there's going to be they're going to have to go through the legislative process. And I think that people did become aware that the pharmaceutical industry was behind those, and I think they rejected both. So the problem you have with that of trying to limit the money is the Constitution. It's the Buckley decision. And unless we find some way to get around that, all we're doing is pushing out the money away from candidates, away from the proponents of the initiatives, but we're not removing money from the system.
Can I ask a question to all three of you? We are all proceeding on the assumption that the initiative process is broken, that it's been captured by the special interest. But if we look at the results, people sort of figure it out. If you look at the results, I may not disagree with all of the decision that the public has made, but the public makes rational decisions. They decided they wanted the Three Strikes Initiative. They decided they wanted to cut property tax with Proposition 13. They decided they wanted to lock in some money for schools with 98. They decided they wanted to limit legislatures' terms. Speaking of the big ones that have had a profound impact on California, I may disagree with some of their decisions, and I think as time moves on, we can see some problems with some of them. But isn't it working in that respect? I mean, this year they made rational decisions about we don't like any of them. No.
Yeah, I've issued a challenge to people, and I'll issue the challenge to this audience, and probably Fred Silva can answer this. Give me an initiative that's passed in California that the voters regretted passing and that today they would reverse. Now, I can think of one. I can think of one.
What is it?
In 1964, the voters voted to ban pay TV. And that means no ESPN, no CNN. And the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. I think today the people would not vote to approve banning pay TV. But there are very few, and there are probably a couple others, very few initiatives that have passed that the voters were fooled into passing. I think they turned down a lot of initiatives where they're fooled into voting no because they're confused. Tracy West in my office talks about the fairness doctrine. And we think that may be a solution, but the problem is it's a federal solution. We used to have the FCC used to require TV stations to give one free ad for every four ads that were broadcast on the other side in ballot measure campaigns. That was up until 1990. And some people say that Prop 103, the insurance initiative, this established the insurance commissioner and gave us a 25% rebate. The reason 103 passed in 1988 was because of the fairness doctrine, where they got one free ad for every four on the other side. If we'd had that with 78 and 79 probably still would have failed, but probably would have gotten more votes and more people would have known that the pharmaceutical industry was behind.
Yeah, but
okay,
given
what you just said is that the voters have sort of done what they wanted to do, right. And do we need reform? Is there a
yes.
Is, why
yes.
do we need
just
why?
Do a let me use the lottery initiative as an example of some of what's not right. And I'm not actually sure that if you went back and did the lottery initiative again that people would pass it. Because they have, I believe, many people have come to realize that the amount of money that goes to schools is extremely small. And the education community has understood that part of what happens is people think we've fully funded education because we have a lottery, when in fact it's something like 2% of the typical school budget. But that was a vendor-financed initiative, right? That was put on the ballot not by school groups or finance groups, but by lottery equipment vendors. And my guess is that people didn't really understand that. They said they saw it was for schools, and that's good. It has provisions in it that prevent it from being amended to do things like reduce the amount of administrative overhead that can be spent on the lottery. It's 10 or 11% in most other big states. The cap in the California Lottery Initiative is 16%. In the legislature, we have no way to cap that, and the lottery is not under the budgetary oversight of the legislature. It was intended to operate like a business, which is fine, except it means nobody has any fiscal oversight, any direct fiscal oversight. All there is a bully pulpit. So one of the problems is not being able to amend after you've passed something unless it's, quote, in accordance with the purposes of the act. Well, amending the lottery initiative to provide legislative oversight of the budget or to reduce the amount of administrative overhead is certainly not in keeping with the provisions that mandated the 16% for overhead, but it's something that I think needs to be able to be done. Recently, initiatives have gotten worse in that regard because they put in provisions like this cannot be amended unless there's a 90% vote of the legislature, making it virtually impossible to change anything, even if it does turn out to be something that people weren't really thinking about when they voted. People vote on initiatives on a big picture, not on the little detail on page 3, lines 4 to 7.
So what are you proposing then in terms of an improvement of the system?
Well, I think you have to have an amendment process that makes it easier to go back or that allows the legislature to place those kinds of amendments before the voters without another signature gathering campaign much more readily.
The legislature could do that right now. A constitutional amendment or a statutory initiative that doesn't allow the legislature to amend, you can put on the ballot anything you want. If you get a two-thirds vote, if you get a two-thirds vote on the lottery, you can put that on the ballot.
Right, but here's the problem, and this comes back to money, which is going to be the root of every single problem we talk about. If you were to put that provision that limits overhead on the ballot, who would fund the yes campaign? Because you have a start with initiatives that it's not good. Look at what happened to Prop 80. If you went out to this state, the citizens of this state, and asked them if they think they should continue to have deregulated electricity after the energy crisis, you would not get a vote result that looked anything like what the result was like on Proposition 80. All of the other polling I've seen are that people think there are real problems with having a market-based system for electricity. But that's not what happened on the ballot because there was no money spent on the Yes on Proposition 80 campaign. So did people really vote no on the fine print of that proposition, or were they voting about the timing of the election and the whole wad of initiatives?
But should people actually be voting on something as complicated as the electricity market at all? Should those kinds of initiatives be on the ballot?
Of course not, in a perfect world. But the electricity re-regulation is something that actually did get through the legislature a number of times, and every version that went through the legislature was vetoed. So that is a use of the initiative process that I think we want to keep, where you've had something that goes through the legislative process, it gets vetoed, there's not a two-thirds override possible. That's one of the things Hiram Johnson had in mind, and I think that was a wise thing.
I want to pause just for a moment because to do some administrative work here. You're listening to a discussion of initiative process reform in California hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project. I want to ask another question to the group. One of the things that we know about the initiative process is that there is a cottage industry, particularly in this city, that feeds off that initiative process. Consultants, ad writers, signature gatherers will make tens of millions of dollars, have made tens of millions of dollars just with this last set of initiatives. So you've got an economic interest in keeping this going. Is there anything that can be done to change that?
Well, I think that's more a reflection of the system. They may want to drive it, but they don't have the ability as much to drive it as a lot of people would think. So, yes, that is part of the problem, that there are some people that are making a lot of money off of it, but I don't think that's going to determine in the end whether something makes the ballot or not, or you get some encouragement from it, and I see it all the time, but I don't find that as being definitive. You do your focus groups and your analysis is what the likelihood is it's going to get on the ballot. So I see that as something that's a negative part of it, but I don't think it's an overriding concern.
Actually, I've heard a WAG refer to that as the initiative industrial complex.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I think there should be more disclosure in terms of how much the consultants are making. But we do suggest as a possible recommendation, which would change a U.S. Supreme Court decision, that there should be contribution limits on initiative campaigns. The city of Berkeley put a $250 limit on initiative campaigns back in the late 70s, and the United States Supreme Court ruled that that was unconstitutional, that it was a denial of the First Amendment. We think perhaps that a $100,000 contribution limit could be placed on initiative campaigns, and the court might look at that differently than $250. The court has basically said you can't corrupt the public. Well, frankly, we think that these huge contributions do, and that if you put large contribution limits, $100,000, maybe higher, on initiative campaigns. The pharmaceutical industry, remember, each of the companies put in close to $10 million each on Prop 78 and 79, $10 million. And the other side had a total of $2 million. So clearly it was not fair. The only thing the other side had was the ballot pamphlet. The ballot pamphlet had pros and cons. League of Women Voters and a few other groups had pros and cons. And one other thing that I found absolutely fascinating this time, I have never seen so many TV stations cover ballot measure campaigns with free media. I mean, they made a bundle of money on the advertising. But in L.A., our NBC station, our ABC station, our Fox station, each devoted an hour long for debates on the initiatives. Up in the Bay Area, the same thing happened. Now, facetiously, we have said, wait a minute, this is interesting. This was because it was a special election. Only initiatives were on the ballot. Maybe we should only have initiatives on a ballot, for instance, in an odd number of years. Maybe all the initiatives should be on the ballot because people focused. I've never heard so much discussion about initiatives as opposed to candidates. Last year, we had 16 initiatives on the ballot. It was a presidential year. Everybody was focusing on Bush Kerry. This year, everybody was focusing on initiatives. So facetiously, we talk about that. But it was really interesting how much free time was given this year by the TV stations.
Well, I think, you know, we're talking about 78 and 79, which were defeated by the voters. I think if you have to look at where money played such an incredibly important role was the amount of union money that came in opposition of these initiatives. So from my selfish, narrow perspective, I would think that, yeah, maybe I would want to have limitations about the money that would enter into the initiative process. My concern is the Constitution. So if you say that you can only give so much money directly to the campaign, you're not going to be able to stop the independent expenditures and individuals spending their own money like Rob Reiner is on his initiative. So all you're doing, again, by setting these limits is you're moving the money away from the people that are making the decisions. I think Proposition 34 was an absolute disaster. Why? Because the members of the Assembly and the members of the State Senate can only raise a fraction of the money that it takes for them to win elections. So what does that do? It empowers the special interests. It empowers the state parties because we now have the funds to make the difference as to whether somebody has the resources they need to win. So I agree that there's an incredible amount of money in the process, but unless we deal with the constitutional issue of they're saying that you can't limit that amount of money that people spend, it's a free speech issue, I don't know how you're going to effectively change that equation.
Well, just in response to that, if I could. If you're right on the independent expenditures, but if they ran independent expenditures, it'd have to say the SEIU sponsored this ad, as opposed to the Committee for Good Government. So you would have Rob Reiner sponsored this ad. So you would know in the TV ad directly who sponsored the ad.
So disclosure is really the essence of it. And I think that's one of the things I tried to get at this year with SB 469, which the governor vetoed, which would have required right on the petition that the top five funders to that particular initiative be listed so that when people are looking at that clipboard and they're trying to decide – do I want to sign this or not? And the person with the clipboard always says, oh, it's just to put it on the ballot. And we like that kind of choice. You know, we want to be able to have all the choices we want and on everything in life. But if you knew whether the circulator was being paid and you knew who the top five funders were, you take a look down, you'd have a very different result. And I'm not saying that we should have a different rule for the pharmaceutical industry, the auto industry, for labor, for any individual. Let that be disclosed. It doesn't get disclosed anywhere near soon enough right now, during the signature gathering and even during the campaign. There are a lot of groups who spent a lot of money on this election that we aren't going to know until next January or later who they were.
I would support that effort.
I'm interested in your solutions, Duff. They come up with a lot on this end. What would you do? How would you reform it?
Well, again, I think my concern is the details and the complexity of the process and making sure that we have the full opportunity to vet them. There was some discussion as to whether it should go to the legislature before the petitions or after. I'm not as concerned about that. But I think having the process be more deliberative is the primary thing that I would focus on. I think the initiative process generally works. If you look at it from my selfish, narrow perspective, usually we've been on the defense on initiatives. So we have been the ones that have been trying to organize the no vote. In this case, we were on the opposite side. But I have general faith in the concept.
Wait a minute. You say you've been on the defense, but if you look at initiatives that have had huge impact in the state,
right,
many of them have huge Republican support. You look at term limits. That was a Republican –
right, but if you look at the 90s, that
you look
was
at Proposition 13.
Right.
Those are the signature initiatives that you look at sentencing, three strikes. That, too, was a Republican effort.
Yeah, but those were really grassroots movements. I mean, if you look at Jerry Brown, he stood up against Proposition 13 because he didn't think it was a good idea. But that was just something where the people rose up. And I think that those situations come along, as you mentioned them, they come along maybe once every 10 years that you have those types of an issue. But if you look at the initiatives that were being proposed for the last 10 years, except taking out what's happened recently, they've been primarily those that have been environmental or labor or things that we haven't necessarily agreed with. So I think we're, but I'm trying to take a step back from my partisan hat and just say that on a general point of view, I think we need to be more deliberative about the process. These things are complicated. There are things in there that really don't pop up until later. So I think we need to flush those out earlier. But in general, I support the initiative process.
You know, you had asked about whether or not some signature requirement was necessary before you send something to the legislature. And I think as a practical matter that you must have some kind of basic hurdle that people meet. I know that all of us have our specially gifted constituents who we hear from on a regular basis, and they have some great ideas, but not every idea is something that should set in motion an enormous amount of work. I mean, I've had somebody, for example, come to me and say, well, I just think it's really silly that you pay $270 for a red light ticket, and that ought to go instead, and they have a particular focus, you know, crossing guards for schools or whatever it is. And you just really don't want for everything – we don't want all of that to rise to the level. It has a huge cost when you start taking every – one of those things and putting it through a process.
Let me ask you about, Deborah, particularly, you're a member of the legislature. How deadening, how difficult is it for a member of the legislature to work on an issue that's difficult, that's controversial, that you have a big special interest opposing it? You get it passed, you may even get it signed by the governor, and then you have that special interest come forward with an initiative to repeal it.
The referendum?
Yes, the referendum, which has happened in the very recent past. How stymied do you folks feel in the legislature, or powerless?
You know, in the last 15 years, I can only think of one measure that's been successfully referended. So I don't think that's a major part of what we're dealing with here. I mean, we're talking much more about placing an issue that's a wedge issue on the ballot for the purpose of bringing out a particular segment of voters, or using a tactic of placing something on the initiative solely to draw money out of a certain area and basically, you know, bleed off money from a certain group of people. So it's a strategic or tactical use of the initiative. It isn't really about the policy that's in it. It's about draining money from one group or another. And I think that's probably people in this room and people here understand that, but voters pretty much deal with initiatives straight up. They're not thinking, well, whose money is this supposed to bleed? They're looking at the policy.
You know, one of the problems I see is the qualification. As I indicated before, you have $1.5 million, you can qualify anything. I think it's about the worst way to decide whether something gets on the ballot to have to circulate it and ask people to sign something outside the supermarket when they're not looking at something.
Well, I would disagree with that because there are some initiatives that have come our way that the people determined based on the focus group that it wouldn't pass that hurdle. So I think you're not giving the people that signed the petitions enough credit because it is perceived as a screen. Now, there are certain situations where I think that, you know, if you have enough money clearly, if you have $5 million that you're willing to spend on gathering the signatures, you're probably going to be able to get it. But to say that that process itself isn't something that goes into consideration is not accurate, at least not in my experience. I think including the people in the process, having them sign the petitions is an important part of the process. And frankly, when people are voting on the initiatives, they know that this is something that a certain number of people have signed on. Now, that may give them a false sense of what it's all about, but I think it's fundamental to the initiative process that it should start with the people.
Well, I think it should start with the people. The question, I guess, is there a better process to decide whether something should get on the ballot? Let me just throw out a few ideas that nobody embraces, but just some ideas. And what I'd like to do is challenge people in the audience and who are listening to this also to come up with a better way to decide whether something qualifies. An idea, you gather 50,000 signatures, and then the Secretary of State does a statewide poll to determine whether people want to get it on the ballot. That's one idea. That people don't like polls, but it's an idea. Another idea, you have to affirmatively go someplace to sign a petition. You reduce the number of signatures needed, but you have to affirmatively go to a fire station or to the registrar of voters. Third idea, you can sign petitions online, or you can also sign.
Well, you can do that now.
You have to print it out
right now.
Or you can also say sign online, but you also say, I don't want it on the ballot. And so you can sign something saying, no, I don't want it on the ballot.
Actually, that's a fascinating idea. If you had a signature gathering phrase, instead of just this advisory, don't put it on the ballot, you might have a very different result in what gets on the ballot. You have a limited amount of time. Let's see if there are more people who say yes, put it on the ballot, or no, who don't. But actually, something that you threw out, I think sort of in passing, is really intriguing me, and that's the idea of separating initiative elections from elections for the governor or the assembly or the Senate. And the reason that intrigues me is it would eliminate a lot of the wedge issue stuff that goes on. If you look at what happened with the affirmative action proposal, for example, where people very clearly didn't want preferences and quotas used, but I don't think if they'd really thought about it, they would have intended to keep the University of California from having the broadest possible pool of students enrolled. But once you put everybody in the position of having to respond yes or no to what's there, even though in reality a much more nuanced response is probably a responsible thing to do, you may get more thoughtful policy making both during the initiative process and a more nuanced, more sophisticated response from your elected officials.
Another thing happens with initiatives, which I'm sure you're all aware of, which is a candidate gets associated with an initiative. So with your Proposition 9, it was Jerry Brown with the after-school program. It became Arnold Schwarzenegger. And several candidates have tied themselves to the initiative. Would separating initiatives from candidates prevent that?
Well, what we have suggested and the Fair Political Practices Commission accepted, but then a court said it was not a right interpretation of the much maligned Prop 34, and I agree with Duff about Prop 34, was that a candidate should not be allowed to raise money for an initiative campaign that he or she controls above the contribution limits. We think if there are contribution limits for a candidate, as there are, there should be contribution limits for the candidate raising money for a committee the candidate controls on ballot measure campaign. You're right. Several politicians have used the initiative process, certainly Pete Wilson with Prop 187 in 1990.
Well, that's a great example of something where he did not endorse it, was not involved in it, but endorsed it and then became tied with
it. He didn't write it. That's right. It was on the ballot.
And he did not want it. But then he embraced it, and
well,
then he's.
John Vandekamp in 1990 sponsored three initiatives as he was running for governor. His initiatives qualified. He didn't.
Right.
But I think for a minute about what it does if you're a candidate to have to go use the process of qualifying an initiative. That basically means that now as a candidate, if you have the $1.5 million it takes to qualify the initiative from somewhere, you have an advantage in your candidacy. And that really changes
really
the
does.
Whole nature of candidacy. If you need to have $1.5 million to have a particular initiative that you qualify, that you're associated with, a lot of people in California who might make an excellent governor or lieutenant governor would never be able to do so because that $1.5 million for the associated initiative is just not in the realm of possibility.
But just to add to that, I think both sides, Republicans and Democrats, are now looking at what initiatives we want to put on the ballot for the 06 election to drive turnout. Mm-hmm. So it is something that goes on. And so if we did have the initiative election at a separate time, I think that would take that factor away as well.
You know, more people voted for and against Prop 13 than voted for the candidates for governor
right.
in 1978. It actually brought out people. And certainly Tom Bradley might have been governor in 1982 had the gun control initiative not been on the ballot at the same time. So clearly the initiatives, on the other hand, and I'll argue against
this. So is
this,
that good or bad, Bob?
Well, it could be bad in the sense that if you have the initiative separately, then candidates are not forced to take positions on it. And voters don't necessarily know how the candidates feel, whereas if they're running at the same time, they are required at debates to say, yes, I either endorse Prop X or I don't endorse it. So there are pros and cons to it, and it's an idea that we've just thought of in terms, because of all the interest this year in the initiatives, we thought this, we would at least throw out the idea of having a separate election. One of our staff members said, you're going to have an election every year. I want an election every 4 years. I don't want to have to vote every year.
Well, that's what, you know, the argument on the other side is the mess. You know, there was all this polling that was done on these issues that were brought before the people. What they didn't poll was whether they wanted the special election, which is what they should have asked. So I think one of the messages that at least we've taken away initially is that the voters are tired of voting. There's this fatigue. There's the donor fatigue. So that would argue against what we're just saying, notwithstanding the
benefits. We would also then combine all the city elections at the same time so that you have – because there are a lot of city elections in the odd-numbered year.
Right.
And if you had all the city elections in November, at least you have some consolidation.
Okay, now we have an opportunity for the audience to ask some questions, and they have some very good ones. I'm going to give you two, and I'll let Duff handle the first one. Has public financing been considered as a reform for the initiative process? That's one question. And the second question is, should initiative or constitutional amendments be placed only on the November general election ballot?
Well, I think with respect to the first issue, by the way, my thesis in college was on campaign finance reform. So this is something that I've really been interested in for a very long time. The problem is the Buckley v. Vallejo decision. And if you look at the national level for the presidential campaign, we have public funding of that election. Yet this year there was more money spent on the presidential election than at any time in our history. And there was the McCain-Feingold, which supposedly was supposed to limit the government, limit the amount of money that went to the national parties. And what happened is these 527s sprung up on both sides that were totally unregulated and were doing things like Swift boat ads and all that sort of stuff. So what we're doing in the name of campaign finance reform is moving the money farther away from the people that have the interest. So I would agree with Deborah and would work with her as hard as I could in terms of disclosure. But I think what we need to do is bring the money back to the people that are responsible, not send it away from them. And I don't think public financing helps that. We've talked about the timing issue. I'm open to that, and I think we've discussed the benefits of having it separately. I think you could say that it should happen at the time of the general elections. The only thing that would argue against that is that people are going to be so focused on what the major issue is, whether it be presidential or governor. I don't think you would get the type of exposure that you got to the issues that we just had this past Tuesday.
I think my suggestion that you use the $5 million and say, okay, if you want it qualified, it's $5 million, but then $2.5 million gets spent on each side was basically a look at, is there a way to create the equivalent of public financing? Because that's what that would do. Yes, there are constitutional issues, but could we in California do an experiment where we say, let's see what happens if on an issue that's very important to people, complicated or not, we actually take how much money who has on either side out of the equation and then see what people decide.
I'm a strong supporter of public financing for candidates. I'm a little skeptical in terms of ballot measures because you had $80 million spent on 78 and 79. We're not going to spend $80 million on the other side, clearly. Now, if you spent maybe $5 million, that might get some message out. The question is, who do you give it to as well? That's another question. The November election idea is an interesting one. We used to require that until the 1970s. And then the Secretary of State interpreted the law to say we could have it on the primaries. And so we've had it primary in general. And the argument in the primary is that it depends on who's voting. If there's a heavy Democratic presidential campaign going on, more Democrats may be voting, the same with Republicans. The problem I see with having it only in November of the even-numbered year, is what Duff said, is that we'd have so many issues on the ballot, number one. I mean, you'd be taking all the issues in the primary, all the issues in the general, combine them together. We're talking about 15, 20, 25 measures on the ballot. And when there are that many measures on the ballot, as we know, the voters just will say no to everything. So that's a problem there.
Okay. This is a question that should be good for you, Deborah. What about initiatives that place requirements on the state budget? Should those still be allowed? And secondly, most states allow their legislatures to amend initiatives after they pass. California doesn't. Should it?
Well, I think you do want to have some provision for initiatives that affect the budget. An initiative that requires California to have a budgetary reserve, for example, I'm
all for.
All for. You do need some fiscal discipline. The difficulty has been that we've gotten ourselves so tied up in so many initiatives that affect the budget that mostly what we've done is create a class of specialty lawyers who specialize in Prop 98 school funding. And I don't think any PTA, run-of-the-mill PTA member could possibly understand the ins and outs of Prop 98. So, again, it's hard to figure out where to draw that line. And the second, should the legislature be able to amend? Yeah, I think the legislature does have to be able to amend things. I would change that two-thirds vote requirement, but keep the referendum there so that if the legislature says, all right, we're going to change the allocation of the tobacco tax money so that we have more programs that go to cessation and or we include health care treatment for certain people who haven't had it. That's a 90% vote requirement right now to change that. We've done it a couple times, and I think, you know, if somebody had sued to say, okay, that really wasn't within it, we probably would have lost. But tying things up at that level of specificity permanently, I think, is really difficult. We are a changing state. You look at the demographics of California in 1911 when the initiative process went into the Constitution, and you think about what society was like, what was regulated, what there was competition in, how many people were graying, how old. If you put something in the ballot that said there's a mandatory retirement age at 45 because it made sense with the lifespan, then what are you going to do, live with that?
What about a mandatory sunset on all of these initiatives?
That's an interesting thought, too, and I, as you were talking earlier, thought some about it. But you get yourself into the problem that we have right now at the federal level with the Voting Rights Act, where because it is sunset, it actually requires an affirmative act of the Congress to pass it again. If something automatically went back on the ballot again, that might be an interesting way to do something. But I would like to think that we would have the ability to learn from our experience with a law rather than just say yes or no. Part of the problem with the initiative process is that it doesn't leave any room for learning about what works or what doesn't work, what's challenged, what's found not to be constitutional. It's a very, very blunt tool. So whatever we do to reform it has to make sure that we enable ourselves to learn from our mistakes and grow.
Yeah, maybe some intermediate step would be that it would require a reaffirmation after a period of years, you know, that you pass an initiative and then 5 years later it comes. I don't know.
Can you imagine how many more initiatives, though? How many more?
Yeah, I know. It's the danger of just thinking off the top of your head. But I think there is a problem here because, you know, you look at 98, which we totally support, but I don't think anybody in this room understands that initially the percentage was set at 40%, but that percentage can only go up and it can never go down. So right now it's at 51% and it's going to keep going up. I mean, that is not what people voted for, and we should have some mechanism to address it, but as I'm sitting up here on the panel, I don't have that magic bullet.
You know, I'm all in favor of allowing the legislature to amend. When we wrote the Political Reform Act, we said the legislature could amend it, provided that it was a two-thirds vote. that the bill was in final form 10 days before the legislature voted on it and that it furthered the purposes. And the legislature has amended the Political Reform Act, I think, over 200 times, and probably 199 of the amendments are good amendments. And so the legislature has done a good job of that. When you talk to some initiative proponents, however, they say if you mandate legislative amendment, if you allow legislative amendment, we're just going to circulate a constitutional amendment, which means it has to go back to the people. And we don't want to expand our Constitution. Do you realize in 1990 we voted on a constitutional amendment to ban gill nets in the ocean? Now, why was that put in the Constitution? I mean, this is ridiculous. So many things in our Constitution don't belong there.
Did we vote on it? Did we vote
yes.
No?
No, we voted. That was one of three initiatives that passed. That year. Three out of 18, that was one of the ones that term limits and gill nets passed.
Okay. Bob, here's you. How about letting voters vote? I don't know how this would impact anything, but I mean, how about letting voters vote, I don't know, instead of just yes or no on an initiative? And here's something that's up your alley. Comment on the idea of initiative commission to hold hearings, amend proposition, in exchange, lower signature gathering threshold for propositions that go through the commission, free media, ad time, et cetera.
That's a very interesting idea. In a sense, it substitutes for the legislature. Maybe people would have more confidence in an initiative commission. Of course, it depends on who's on the commission and what their powers are.
They better not be retired judges.
The I don't know. People can vote I don't know right now by just not voting on the initiative. I mean, it's a yes, no, and they don't vote. The question, in Italy, it takes a majority of the people voting a majority of the registered voters to pass something. And so the Catholic Church urged people not to vote at all. And even though the people voted on something dealing with abortion, voted yes on it, because unless the majority actually voted, it didn't pass. So that's another idea. But remember, only 42% of our voters, registered voters, voted in this last special election. That actually was high for a special election.
You know, I think a great deal of merit in having, not necessarily I don't know, but skip this race be one of the choices on the ballot, in that it would help people know whether or not they were undervoting. When we have electronic voting and you have the paper ballot that's shown there, you would be able to see if you've chosen skip this race in a particular race, and it would solve the problem of people accidentally missing a race or not voting. I mean, you get a long ballot like that, you may come back to something and then forget, oh, I didn't vote for the third judge's race down. And if you intended to because you feel like you just shouldn't be deciding, you don't know who the people are, that's fine. But I think a lot of people undervote on things because they inadvertently have missed one race or one initiative in a long ballot.
Let me say, I had 100 decisions to make in 1990 on my ballot. 100 decisions to make. I count the number of decisions each year. I had to go to two different polling booths because they didn't have enough room in the first one. When you talk to people around the world, how many decisions do you have when you vote? It's one, two, maybe three decisions. So we impose a tremendous burden on our California voters, and we wonder why they don't vote. It's because they're overwhelmed.
All three panelists, the questioner says, have support the initiative process. Do they or would they support a federal initiative and referendum process?
I'd have to give that more thought. Off the top of my head, I wouldn't oppose it.
Well, we do have a process for amending the Constitution, and it's something that's very difficult to do, which is why we still don't have an Equal Rights Amendment in the federal Constitution. But that has a lot of implications for the potential balance of power among the states that I think are not to be addressed in an off-the-cuff kind of manner.
Yeah, I'd be glad to look at it.
I asked a good friend of mine, I said, what do you think of the California initiative process? Should we keep it? He said, absolutely we keep it. It's very important. I said, how about a federal initiative? He said, oh, no way. I think we should seriously consider it, except on foreign policy questions. I'm not sure that we should be dealing with actual vote on Iraq might be an interesting idea, wouldn't it? Maybe an advisor. We should maybe start with an advisory vote where people could circulate something saying, should we stay in Iraq or should we have abortion rights, and have an advisory vote so Congress has an idea. I think it would certainly energize our federal politics. I mean, the problem now is you have 99% of the congressmen reelected every year, not just in California, everywhere. So there's not that much competition. There would be certainly a lot of competition of ideas if we had advisory issues starting with that on the ballot.
I'm going to stop for a moment to remind our radio audience that you're listening to a discussion of initiative process reform in California hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project. Next question. Over 40% of California adults read at an eighth grade level or less. Is it possible to require that initiatives be presented in plain language? Are they presented in plain language? Do people have trouble understanding what they are? Certainly they had some problems with Proposition 80 this time and 79 and 78.
The law says that the analyses are supposed to be done, I think, at a 12th grade level, and that's what the law says. Now, you're right, Prop 80 was just impossible to understand for most of us. But I think and there are some groups that do put out easy voting guides. And I think, you know, the Internet is really going to change campaigning. I mean, I think the Internet is just a tremendous opportunity for voters to learn much more. And we would then go further and have and we had this year something called a Voter Minute, where we had somebody do pros and cons on video with a side screen showing the words and standing in front of an area that would be related to the initiative. And it was extremely well done. In about a minute and a half, this person, we were able to write something that showed the pros and cons, who is supporting, who is opposing. And so I think the use of the Internet, the use of video voter minutes, television on demand, I think we may be revolutionizing the way people get information. And those people who want it, and that's not necessarily a majority of us, but those people who want more information now are able to get plenty of information about these initiatives.
No, I think the problem often is too much information, not too little information, and then the accuracy of the information. And for me, what came to mind in the discussion about how things are written is things like the League of Women Voters Voter Guide. What are the trusted sources? And then immediately I thought about the problem with the slate mailers on Proposition 78 and 79, where we had the pharmaceutical industry. I really don't mean to pick on the pharmaceutical industry. They just have given me a lot of examples to use today. They had spent a lot of money on some slate mailers that were in favor of Prop 78 and opposed to Prop 79. And on those, one of them was aimed at the African-American community. And it had the pictures of Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Barbara Lee, Senator Murray, Assemblyman Dimely, various other people. And it made it appear as though those members of the legislature and Congress were supporting that position, when in fact all of the people whose pictures were on those slate mailers had taken exactly the opposite position to what was there. But there was a tiny little disclosure in probably, you know, type that not even a 16-year-old could read without a magnifying glass. So clearly we need to look at the question of slate mailers and what's implied. We've done some work in that regard. There's a tiny little star that says whether or not someone's paid to be on a slate mailer. Someone earlier had the proposal, it may have been you, Bob, that we put dollar signs by the person's name to indicate what's been paid, and I think that's a great idea. People understand what a dollar sign means. An asterisk can mean all kinds of things.
Okay. Well, I think the problem is much deeper than that. I mean, obviously, from my side, you look at ads that say the governor has been slashing educational spending, and it's up 8% under his administration. So just, you know, there's a lot of different ways that you get at the truth, and I think that's it's a difficult thing to regulate when people aren't being truthful, as they weren't in that situation, but clearly also weren't when they were talking about what the governor's record is.
Okay, we are at the two-minute level, so I have time for one more question. Unfortunately, I have two very good questions, but I'm going to just pick one because I'm interested in it. What do you think about initiatives at the local level to dictate land use? Should there be restrictions on what can be decided by the initiative process?
There was an initiative, I think it was Livermore, where the developer company spent $3 million trying to influence, I don't know, 20,000, 30,000 voters. The developer lost, even though the other side didn't spend very much money. Try to take away the right of the initiative process from voters, and you will have a voter revolt. I think the voters want that opportunity, and so I think that almost everything should be open to the process, because otherwise the voters are going to be really upset at what you're trying to do.
Time and time again, I think they've made the right decision, and I think we can always improve the system, but I think that over time, if you look on balance, they've done a pretty good job with this process.
Even on land use?
Absolutely. I think Bob brought up one example, and I think historically they've done a good job of finding the right way to go.
Thank you. I'd like to thank our panelists for their contributions to this afternoon's discussion. They are State Senator Deborah Bowen, Robert Stern, President, Center for Governmental Studies, and Duff Sundheim, Chairman of the California Republican Party. We would also like to thank our audience on radio and on TV and you folks here. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you.